Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. It is my pleasure to welcome Stan B.H. Tan Thang Bao to the program. Professor Tan Thang Bao is a Vietnamologist, and today we're discussing his book, co-authored with Quyen Van Minh, Playing Jazz in Socialist Vietnam, Quyen Van Minh and Jazz in Hanoi, out in 2021 with the University Press of Mississippi. Professor Tan Thang Bao, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much, Adam. It's my pleasure.
Can you tell us about why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm a Vietnamologist. When I started my research in Vietnam, that was back in 1997, I never thought I would find jazz in Vietnam. So prior to going to Vietnam, I was very much a jazz enthusiast. So I've been listening to jazz for a very long time. Musically, I'm literate, but I can't really play music that well. I can do some basic stuff on the saxophone, very, very fundamental stuff on the guitar. That's about it. But I listen to jazz every day. So that's the first thing I do in the morning and the last thing I do before I go to bed. So when I started doing field work in Vietnam back in 1997, I didn't expect to find any jazz. And I was in the villages in the Mekong Delta, so there wasn't any jazz. And by the time I finished my field work, the first thing I do when I get home in Singapore, I put on some jazz music. Then along the way, as I started traveling to Hanoi, I found out that there was a jazz club in Hanoi. And so I visited the jazz club. It was quite nice. Was quite nice. At that time, they move around a fair bit. Then later on, in 2001, Quyen Van Minh and his band visited Singapore. They did like a 9-day tour in Singapore, giving performances all over the place, including at the National University of Singapore. So I heard them, I was fascinated. So I went back to Vietnam again, went back to the jazz club, I bought his CD, I met up with him, I got his autograph. So every time I visited Hanoi, I would go to the jazz club in the evening and sit down there for at least a set. But it just never crossed my mind that someone should write something about jazz in Hanoi. I mean, like most people just find it's a novelty, it's fascinating to have jazz in Hanoi. But over time, as I started talking to Minh and he started telling me his stories about how he started playing jazz in Vietnam, listening to jazz, just thought, hey, wait a minute, that is a really fascinating story in the sense that it just kind of rang in my head that jazz in Vietnam is quite an unlikely thing. And he started doing all this thing, opening a jazz club back in the 1990s. Wow, that was something. I remember being in Vietnam in the late 1990s and it wasn't easy. A lot of things were like kind of like under very tight controls. What CDs we could bring in, what music we could bring in, what books we could bring into Vietnam, this was all tightly controlled. And the best part was this, because I've heard him play in Singapore and he introduced quite a fair bit of his original compositions. They call it Vietnamese jazz. And it is, as I really listened to it, it was really a very nuanced original sound. And to think about this, a jazz club in Hanoi, in the old capital city, the current political center, of all places in Hanoi, they play 3 sets every night at that time before switching on to 2 sets because the clubs have to be closed by 12 midnight. Before that, they could close at 1 or 2 a.m. That's fine. And it's really jazz every night, 7 days a week. They don't close until Tet holidays. That's the Vietnamese New Year. I was thinking, this is something we should start writing about, you know, doing some research. It tells you a lot of stories about it. So I started, because my own work was based in the Central Highlands and then later on in the Northern Uplands of Vietnam and then across the border to China. So I started doing some research to see, if anyone has written anything about jazz in Vietnam. To my surprise, none. So I thought maybe someone should write this story. So but it just didn't cross my mind that I would be the one doing it. So what happened was that I started to get to know Ming better because I go to his club so often. And I just sit there with my beer, enjoy the music. Sometimes he would sit down and talk with me. So there was one night we sat and we started talking during the set. And after the set, he brought over a bottle of whiskey. I remember it was a Johnny Walker Black Label, a very simple bottle of whiskey. And we started sitting down and we started drinking. He said he has a flight to catch later in the morning. So it's okay, we just talk and he'll go straight to the airport from the club. So we started talking and he told me more stories of his childhood, how he started learning jazz and all that. I think I must be pretty drunk by then. And I suggested to Ming that, you know, someone should write your story. And he said, well, no one's writing. I mean, I have a lot of reporters come and go, they'll interview me, write short stories in there, but no one really sat down to say that they are going to write a biography or help me write a memo. So I suggested to him that, why don't you let me try? But the thing is, because I'm so busy with other projects, you have to give me time, not like a few months, like a few years. The next thing I know, I think we bottoms up our whiskey. We shook our hands and the project was born. So that was how the project came about. And it, to this day, I'm still quite surprised that not too many Vietnamologists are interested in knowing more, studying more, analyzing more about the existence of jazz in Vietnam. So yeah, so that's my response to your first question.
And this book has so much in it. I learned about jazz. I learned about Vietnam. I learned about his life. What audience did you have in mind with this book?
So as I mentioned, the origin story of the book was that I told Ming that I'm going to write your biography. So when I suggested that, it was just a simple biography. You know, then as I started interviewing him and working on the interviews, planning out how we're going to do this, I was teaching at the National University of Singapore. I thought, maybe I should write something a little bit more sophisticated, something that is more within the field of Southeast Asian studies, or Vietnam studies to be more specific. So that was the plan, that I would write for the Vietnam studies, the Southeast Asian studies, the Asian studies readers, something that's very scholarly. Then over time, as I start working with him, I realized that I really need to fill in a lot more of the gaps, you know, the background, and do some comparative work with the stories of jazz elsewhere. There wasn't much in Asia. Most of the studies would cover were about Japan, a little bit about China, before the communists came to power. Bits and pieces here and there on other countries, very little. But there were a lot written about North America and Europe. So I thought, I should write this book in such a way that it should also address the readership in jazz studies and, to a certain extent, ethnomusicologists. By that time, the structure, the format of the book was still very much on, I would call it something like a socio-political history of Vietnam through the life story of Ming and jazz in Vietnam, in Hanoi to be more specific. So that was the original plan. But I wasn't very comfortable with it when I started trying writing about what I have at the materials that I have at that time, because I felt that I wasn't doing justice to this person, to this incredible musician. I wasn't doing justice to the story of jazz and the many people who took part in this endeavor, whether together or separately, individually, collectively. And I thought, I need to spend more time on it. I have to take a different approach. So what was initially just a 2 to 3 year project dragged on. Then there was also some personal junctures in my own life, which I wasn't productive for a couple of years. So something happened in my own life. I wasn't very productive in my academic career for a couple of years. Then I moved to Japan. So after moving to Japan, my wife reminded me that it seems to me you owe someone a book. They say, that's true. So at that time, I was very busy with Kachin Life Stories, a public anthropology project. I said, yes, I owe someone a book. I should finish that up. So I made an effort that every year I would spend 1 month, at least 1 month, in Hanoi with me. And he said, yes, please, let us continue with that. I know you're still working on it. So throughout for that 5 to 6 years in Japan, I would spend about 1 month with me. So when I started doing that, I realized that, actually, I'm not just writing for academics. I'm also writing for the musicians in Vietnam, those people who took part in this endeavor. And the people who have been supporting me all this time, his audience, his fans. So it was then that I realized that this book has got to be written in a rather nuanced way. It cannot be the usual way I, as an academic, approach it, writing in very dense language, very analytical, with a lot of information data thrown in and analyzed. It has to feature Ming's voice. So the audience I have in mind started to change. I have to write for both the general audience, his fans, as well as academics. So that's how that conception of the audience should change, and the writing kind of continue to drag on because I have to experiment a little bit with the first couple of chapters that I started writing. And it helped that there was this rather avant-garde journal at that time, the Journal of Narrative Politics. They really liked this kind of stuff. So I tested the very first chapter I wrote up with them, and they gave very good advice and suggestions on how to really make it work. So I published one chapter with them. It was very well received. And when I looked at it, this is something I'll go back to it again and again, because usually we don't like to read our own stuff. But I went back to them. So I did that. I realized that, so this is kind of like that eclectic approach I can use to address the different readers that started coming into the project that I thought would be able to address the different readers that I started to imagine. So that's why the book is the way it is. And I think for the readers, regardless of where you hang your jacket. That is, whether you see yourself as an academic, an anthropologist, an ethnomusicologist, a fan, a non-fan, I think you will pick up this book and go through it. Sorry for my really long answer to that.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah, the bulk of the book is told using Mr. Main's own words. Can you talk about your decision to move in that direction?
Sure. So I kind of alluded to that in my earlier answer. So in the book, I describe this style of writing as an exercise in collaborative narrative writing. It's quite fascinating because I thought I really want to use his voice, but this is not going to be a transcription of our conversation. So this is how I have to address this question, in the sense that the book was based on a lot of our informal conversations. Sometimes we recorded these informal conversations. I took my recorder, I said, Ming, we are just going to have drinks, we're going to just smoke and talk. I want to switch on the recorder. He said, go ahead. So a lot based off that. And there were a lot of interviews like sessions that went on for like 3-4 hours. Some of these interviews were recorded on video, some were not. Some parts of it were recorded, some parts were not, because I forgot to switch on the recorder, for example, or the battery ran out, or these kind of things happened along the way. So we had all these kind of so-called recorded sessions, unrecorded sessions, a little bit more formal sessions, very informal sessions. And he would talk about the same topic in a very different way, to connect to this part of the story, to connect to the other aspects of his life. So when I started going through all the interviews that we have listening to, then I find that if I just transcribe what he said, it won't work. It makes sense to me because I spent so much time with him. It's not going to make sense to anyone else. So what I did was, when I find after this, like after almost, let's say, 8 years of conversations, what I did was I started to piece together, when I wrote that first chapter, I pieced together different parts of our conversations on this topic, that he keep repeating this topic, but with different things, different information, alluding to different things, connecting different things. I pieced together one part, I pieced together another part, that is the same topic from over 8 years. So that it kind of reads like a flowing topic. If he had edited it himself, it might look like that. And this other information that he has will go into another aspect. So they are all in there. So I tried that now. I worked with him. Okay. So I told him, this is the account of the story you told me. Basically, the points we covered here, they are this, 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 and this. Works? See? Yeah. You know the story. So I started writing, and it kind of really brings up his persona and brings out his background as well. As a Vietnamese musician who grew up during the 1950s and 60s, then transitioned through the 70s, that's after reunification, to the early 80s. What most Hanoians will tell you, the toughest part of life was in the early 80s before the Doi Mui reforms that opened up the market and the whole world changed. So the way he tells his stories reflect that transition. And the only way I think that can be presented to the reader was to try to keep intact the phrases that he used, the chronology of the story that he remembers, and sometimes the repetition. So you'll find in the book, certain things kept repeating throughout the book, but in a different, slightly different way. So that explains why the writing uses I, that's me talking to the reader. But it's also filled with my own interventions. Now, my own interventions these were actual interventions in the sense that when we're having that conversation, and when he talks about, for example, his second encounter with Jazz, a vinyl record that a friend brought back from Eastern Europe. And he said, there was Jazz there. And I started, oh yes, I read about this. So we started having that discussion about Jazz in Eastern Europe. There's Jazz in socialism. This shouldn't be a problem here. And he started telling all those related stories that I managed to bring up in the other chapters. So those interventions were in many ways my actual interventions. So, but because this is going to be my voice, so I tried to write it in a more easy to access manner, but analytically informed fashion for the reader. So keeping in mind that my readership is quite broad. So it's quite difficult to balance how academically centered is the language going to be, the analysis is going to be, and then compare it to another reader just coming in. So that's why you have all those intervention passages for me. And that was at a time when I realized that I have to place this. His story is not just based in Vietnam. It's very global, because without all those things happening, it wouldn't happen. Which is why I have those two interludes. Interlude one, Jazz behind the Iron Curtain. Interlude two, Jazz in Asia, to let readers see the larger context in which Jazz has similar challenges in Asia, wherever it was played, from Japan, China, India, and Southeast Asia. So that kind of explained the style of writing.
And Mr. Min's life mission, really, as you write in the book over and over again, is to bring jazz to Vietnam, right? You use the term the soundscape of Vietnam, to bring jazz into the soundscape of Vietnam. Can you talk about some of the difficulties he's faced in trying to achieve this?
Sure. I think the first difficulty, as is very clearly revealed in Ming's own story, was the musical context. So Ming himself was born in 1954. From 1954 onwards, you wouldn't be able to find any more jazz, whatever that was, early swing, dance hall music, Western popular music. You wouldn't be able to find that in Northern Vietnam, in the socialist Vietnam. From 1954 onwards, what you have would be, if since there were no jazz, you would have a lot of revolutionary music. So by revolutionary music, we're talking about, they call it Nhạc Đỏ or red music. So you have basically around about two types. One is revolutionary songs for people to sing, to encourage them to join in, support the revolutionary effort of changing Vietnam, fighting the war, changing society. So it's filled with that, loads and loads of that. And this was the only music that was like really encouraged, that you could really hear in the radio. The second type of revolutionary music, which took a little bit of time to come up, are more orchestral or instrumental music. So you have a lot of all these very reputable Vietnamese composers writing instrumental orchestral based compositions to support the revolution, the war effort, and all that. You do hear them, but not as often as the revolutionary songs. You hear a lot of this on radio. So then the next set of songs that you will hear on radio and you hear in live performance by the song and dance troupe, the artist troupes, etc., will be traditional folk and ethnic music, as imagined by the regime. Because not all traditional music good, not all arrangements fit the revolution at that time. So he has to fit the regime's conception of what is good ethnic music, what is good and appropriate ethnic music and folk music. You hear that too. Then of course there are foreign music at that time, but mainly foreign revolutionary songs, compositions, or folk music from communist, socialist allies, North Korea, China, Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. You hear that, but not as much as this. Some classical music as well, but not as much compared to the former group. So that is the soundscape. That was the music context. So basically, Ming was trapped in this. But informally, there were light music. What was light music? Music that has very little political or no political connotations at all. These were allowed for informal occasions. You can play that for weddings, birthday celebrations, social get-together, so long as it's not in the official stage and not in the public sphere. So you have that, and Ming would hear this music from his parents, other senior musicians playing. He himself later played some of this music, quite a lot of this music, especially for weddings. So they'll play old instrumental dance music, Western dance music, songs like La Paloma, Simone. And they play a lot of pokers, believe it or not, a lot of pokers for people to do social dancing. So that's a soundscape. But there's no jazz. It's quite difficult to imagine someone falling in love with jazz in this musical context. Then there is also the social musical context, in the sense that, number one, an instrument like the saxophone, which is the most closely related to jazz music, was not very, socially accepted. It's just treated as an instrument that's only play dancing, fun music. It's not a serious, proper, mainstream instrument. So you wouldn't see this on the official stage. And not much. There were, but not many people were doing it. So for him to learn saxophone, it took a while to really get into that. Then the third thing is that we know the context of music within Vietnam, and there's really not much access to external music. You know, in those days, if you have a radio, you have to register it with the government. And when you register it with the government, you have to fill in a form and issue you a small booklet. And beneath, right on the front page of the small booklet, is listening to enemy radio stations prohibited. So you can tune and all that, but if anyone caught you listening to enemy station, you'd be in trouble. So that's what happened to Ming, because he was tuning, and he found jazz, which was quite likely Willis Conover's Music USA jazz album, a few times or a few nights in a row, and his father found out. The father stopped him from doing that, gave away the radio. But that was his first encounter with jazz. So there's this taboo, in the sense that you're not supposed to listen to this kind of music. Then, even if you started learning it. So Ming heard these sounds, totally fascinated by it. But if he's going to play phrase for phrase or the entire tune that he can remember, he will be playing it alone. No one could play it for him, because not too many people were listening or have the ability to just catch what they heard once or twice and just play it out this way. And also, if you just play jazz as exactly what he heard from the radio, there's no audience. People say, what nonsense are you playing? Don't do that. So he has to like take what he has heard and just sneak in phrases here and there to make the normal pokers, light music, dance music, and playing a little bit more bouncy, a little bit more interesting. And people find, oh, that's nice stuff. He's a very good player. We've never heard anyone play like this, but without any suspicion that he's playing jazz. So that was the musical context, and it's a huge difficulty in a sense. But it ended up with him doing this by himself all alone. Then the next thing, of course, is clearly the political context. This was during the war years. As we all know, jazz is originated from America. So if you outrightly tell people this is jazz, it's like, no, you're not supposed to play American music. We're fighting a war with them. So it turned out that for someone like Ming, is that he didn't even know that music he was listening to was called jazz for a long time, until much later. So you can't do that. There's no way you can do that openly. You mentioned the word jazz. Sorry, you shouldn't do that. Please don't. And they were in the midst of very intense socialist revolution. You have the agrarian land reforms. Then you have the collectivization of production, of agriculture. All effort, all resources were focused on the socialist revolution and the war. So if you are a musician, you're supposed to contribute to these two things with your musical talent and nothing else. If you're doing anything that's frivolous, that's not contributing to this, you're wasting valuable resources. You're unproductive. So again, you can't do that. That's a limitation. And of course, then there is the cultural context in the sense that, yes, they have social dancing that they inherited from the colonial era and all that. And then there's the connotation that early days jazz, swing, and all those dance hall music. These are improper, morally questionable. So that is also a problem, culturally speaking. How are you going to position jazz? As what it is, or what people thought it was, or something else? So these were the two sets of real challenges that Ming faced when he started discovering jazz. He has to be very careful. And this is revealed in his three encounters with jazz in the book, until the day he actually presented a version of jazz in the public sphere later.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit more about these three encounters. We've already mentioned the first one was with this transistor radio that his father then took away. The second one was with a vinyl record a couple years later, right? With a friend brought it from Eastern Europe. And then the third one?
The third one was when he traveled to Saigon after the war. And he talked to me about Saigon was under American influence for a long time. By then he knew this was called jazz. By then he knew this was strongly associated with American music. He was very careful. So when he was in Saigon, he was like, I'm going to find jazz in Saigon. He walked around those shops selling, they have that this long street of shops selling vinyl records, cassette tapes in Saigon. But by then people had either destroyed their collection, gave away their collection, or hidden it somewhere, and they won't let anyone know. Especially if you are a stranger from the north, they can tell by your accent straight away, and by the clothes you wear, so different from us. So when Ming was doing that, trying to find this, he couldn't find anything until he started asking around. I mean, he has a certain charm about him, a very earnest charm that, look, I'm just interested in music. Nothing else. I have no other motives. And you will believe him because that is really what he is. So, and in the book, I recounted this episode where the man selling all these old cassettes were persuaded by his sincerity and dug up one cassette for him. Say, we can try this. He saw the cover, black man with a band and a woman saying, oh, this stuff must be jazz, but you have to be very careful because money doesn't come easy. And he had the man try it out on a cassette tape player. Oh, okay, that's the music I want. Then he had another problem. I don't have a cassette tape player. So what if I could buy a cassette? And he offered to buy the player. He didn't have enough money. He thought, I'm going back to borrow from my friend. I'm going to come back and get this player. And he asked the man to hold the machine for him. The man was like, look, if you're really so interested, why don't you just give me what you have and take the player and the cassette with you? So with that single cassette, he listened to it. He transcribed whatever he could until the tape you can't play and was totally destroyed from all the repeated listening. He transcribed it and started practicing and make sense of it himself. So that third encounter was really very crucial because that was like a full indulgent kind of encounter with jazz music, and it changed everything for him. That really allowed him to start bringing something very different to the years of other musicians in the late 1970s. Because what happened in Vietnam, especially in the north in the late 1970s, was that after the war, people, this was peacetime Vietnam, before the border war with China, people really wanted music that's more lighthearted. And it was also the belated hippie era. People were listening to disco. All this music from the south, rock and roll, disco started coming up north. People don't really want to listen to fight another war. There's no war to fight now. The agrarian reforms, we are now all collectivized. What else do you want? So they wanted light music. That's what music historians call the light music era in the late 1970s. But the problem is this. A lot of the northern musicians were so used to the red music, the revolutionary music, the very straightforward music of their time. They grew up with that and traditional music that they had a hard time keeping up with this more upbeat, more free-flowing style of rock and roll, a bit of jazz, instrumental rock, etc. So when Ming was able to do all this throughout his years of encounter jazz experimentation, and then that third encounter, he was able to bring something different. It was fresh to the ears of everyone, and it allowed him to really stand up and establish a name for himself in the late 1970s and early 1980s as one of those front runners of light music. So those three encounters were significant in terms of the early development of ideas, musical ideas.
And so now we've talked a little bit about the late 70s and the early 80s, and Mr. Ming at this time is in his late 20s, and then he enters his 30s, and then the Doi Moi reforms happen, and everything changes, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, let me see. Okay, yeah. So the first change, set of changes that all these musicians experienced with the coming of Doi Moi was the economic condition of being a musician, of being an artist in socialist Vietnam. During the subsidy period, that is before the Doi Moi reforms, under the central command economy, musicians receive not just a salary, they also receive income in kind, like milk powder, a bit more rice, sugar, a bit more meat here and all this, to make sure that they are able to fulfill their responsibilities as artists and continue to improve themselves. So that was significant in the sense that if you are a musician of certain grade, of the soloist chair, you get a little bit more, a little bit more. It was a luxury. So benefits everyone, the family. You were really able to provide for your family. But with the Doi Moi reforms, the market economy, that was no longer sufficient. If you want to buy a a little bit more books, for example, to have your children able to learn some English on their own, you'll buy it from the market. That costs money. Everyone was transitioning from the bicycle to the motorbike. Milk powder is not going to get you a motorbike. You have to do something else. So, and that was also a time when you could start taking gigs as a licensed musician, as a professionally trained musician. You could take commercial gigs. People would pay you a lot more money than your salary to do like a 30-minute gig for birthday celebration, anniversary celebration, all kinds of things. So you have to start doing that in the sense that if you still rely on what you have, you can't do anything for a family. You can't take care of them. They can't learn new things. They can't have better jackets. They can't have better clothes. They can't eat better. Everything changed. So the economic condition changed. So they really have to be able and be willing to take up all these side gigs outside their official work. So that's the thing. And it's also at the same time that a lot of music that were prohibited, restricted, pre-war music, or what we call the Nyak Kin Chin, and what was branded as yellow music, Nyak Van, especially the southern Vietnamese popular music, that were prohibited, it was slowly rehabilitated after the Doi Mui reforms, because people really want to listen to this music. And there were a lot of gigs for people to come, for musicians to play these kind of songs. Finally, after 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, we could listen to these songs again. And these are the gigs that pay really well and allows them to do it. So for me at that time, this was a double-edged opportunity in the sense that, okay, I do this, I could earn pretty good money and take good care of my family. I could even establish a very good name for myself as a musician. But that also means that he probably has to compromise on his mission of bringing jazz to Vietnam. Because once you go down that path, you'll be associated as someone who runs after the market. In Vietnamese, call it tell teacher. So, but Minh wants to make sure that he continues to develop his reputation, his respectability as not just a musician, as an artist. Which brings me to my third point, that is, for Vietnamese musicians, they are considered as professional musicians because that's their job. They're all professionally trained, but not all. Minh himself never went to school to study music. But so long as you're employed by a professional performing arts troupe, you're a professional musician. As a professional musician, you're simply known as a nhạc công or a music laborer. Your job is to produce music. That's it. But you want to also be respected as an artist, as a nghệ sĩ. So in order to do that, you need to not just have solid skills, musicality as a musician, but you need to have products. You need to show that you can produce something different. Write your own music. So if you keep going the other route of making good money, becoming a popular musician, it's quite difficult for you to be recognized for your artistic pursuits. I'm not saying the others are not artists, they are, but here you have in the Vietnamese music circle, you have this thing called nghệ thuật chất lượng cao, meaning high artistic values as determined by the state institutions, such as the Association of Musicians, the National Music Conservatoire, and of course, all these performing arts troupes. You're supposed to be the best, then they hire you. So if you're doing nonsense, like, oh, why are you doing that? So this kind of became a double-edged sword. So again, things change in the sense that you have to decide which route you're gonna make. And of course, the two other things that matter for the changes that came with Doi Mui, of course, that's one, the availability of other musical resources in terms of music from overseas. in the early years, it's not much played on the radio or television. It has to be vetted through to make sure that these are proper things that we can broadcast to the public. People will bring in cassette tapes. Foreigners will bring heavy metal, rock, jazz, different kind of music for people to listen to. Music scores, fake books for jazz musicians. They're like, whoa, what's all this thing? Oh, we can actually do that. Instruction books, instruction videos, all these things musicians like. I mean, they start being professional musicians. They have more access to than other people because of the exchanges with visiting musicians arranged by the embassies and all that. And of course, the final thing was the political loosening of control, culturally speaking, in the sense that they want musicians to really try, you know, things are changing. Try and be creative again. Of course, under the purview of the regime, many got into trouble, some did not. So you really have to maneuver very carefully. And Ning was very much aware of that, especially after the Zheng Dian episode. Guitarist and singer who wrote songs that talk about society, the suffering society, the state of society at that time. And he got into trouble in Ho Chi Minh City, had to run back to the north. He's actually from the north. He was actually in the same troop as Ming when all those things happened. So Ming was like, okay, we have to be really careful. So these were the things that changed, and these were the kind of difficulties that they started to face with all these new opportunities as well.
And at the same time, Mr. Min also had personal problems going on that affected his life, right? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, those personal problems actually started back in the 70s, when the first one was when he was initially playing in a song and dance troupe in Hat Tai, which is just outside of Hanoi. And his father and mother wanted him to transfer over to Hanoi, back to Hanoi, to Tang Long Song and Dance Troupe, one of the premier troupes in Vietnam. He passed the audition, but when they asked for his, do you have a diploma in music? He said, no, I study at home. How could I have a diploma? And they said, sorry, we cannot accept you. By then, he had already left Hat Tai Troupe. So he had no work unit that he was attached to. He stayed at home. So when the neighborhood was doing the, what they call the labor booklet, so lao dong, he was one of those unemployed, unproductive, unconscientious member of society. So he was sent up to the neighborhood committee for criticism every night. And he had to do self-criticism as well. So he quickly found another job through a friend, working in the College of Sports and Physical Education, but not as a musician. He was just working in the propaganda unit where he have to play some music for the people to do exercise, help them with their artistic productions and all that. But he wasn't really playing with it, but it gave him a lot of time to practice the saxophone. So that was the first, I would say, musical crisis in his life, in the sense that suddenly I'm not a professional musician. So with that, he went back. Later on, he was able to join a professional troupe and then rejoin the professional music scene. In, by the early 1980s, after the third encounter, he was superb, his playing. So he auditioned for the Tang Long Song and Dance Troupe again. They were so amazed. They said, look, you have got to join us. This is what we're offering you now. They said, you don't remember me? You rejected me several years ago because I didn't have a diploma. You know, I still don't have a diploma. They said, it's no longer important. We want you. So they allowed him back. But then soon after that, he had another problem in the sense that his first marriage started to break down. So he divorced his wife, became a single father to two kids. And that's when Doi Moi happened, the mid-1980s. So we mentioned earlier that if you don't start taking up more gigs, have better income, it's very difficult for you to take very good care of your family at that time. So if he keeps doing all these gigs, he can't take care of his, all these gigs, he can't take care of his two children. So he has to make a choice. And he was offered a chance by a friend to, why don't you go and do some trading business with me? By then, the north-south train line in Vietnam was one of the, was the busiest conduit for travel. You can make very good money by doing trading along that line, buying and selling, buying and selling. So his friend, and he had did some gigs, informal gigs for the railway agency before, and he said, you know, these opportunities are available, this is how you can do it properly. And it was very attractive because his friend was making a lot of money. But that means he can't play music. So that was the second musical crisis in life of making that decision or not. Well, he didn't choose to be a trader, lucky for us. Then the third crisis came later on, was when it's kind of, it could be seen as a crisis and opportunity, was when he was given the opportunity to change his role. He was invited to join the National Conservatoire after his two solo recitals in 1988 and 1989. To join the National Conservatoire as a lecturer of saxophone. Now, to us, this might not seem like a problem. You're still a musician, yeah? And the National Conservatoire is a lot more prestigious. But it is a problem in Vietnam in the sense that he already arrived at that pinnacle of his career as a performing musician. So in Vietnamese, you call him a Nhạc sĩ biểu diễn. It's very different from someone who's a teacher. So he has already done that. But to be as a credible, recognized teacher at the National Conservatoire, you need to have the diplomas, the degree, the formal training, string of recitals, awards. And most of these lecturers were trained overseas at very, very prestigious conservatoires in Europe, such as Tchaikovsky Conservatoire. So that crisis was for him was, if I continue to stay as a performing musician, I could do a lot of things. But if I transition over there, I am a nobody. But I could start from scratch and do two things that I've always wanted to do. Number one is to teach the saxophone at the National Conservatoire, because no one was, the saxophone was never a major, not even a minor, because it was not seen as a proper mainstream instrument. It was an instrument for fun. So he could create something really, really valuable over there. The second thing, they allow him, if you're teaching that, of course you have to teach jazz. Although not at that time, not yet as like a major or even a minor, because to learn a saxophone, you have to learn different things. So he was allowed to do that. But the thing is, that means he can't take up as many gigs as he used to do when he was a performing musician. So as a lecturer at the National Conservatoire, you cannot just take any gigs that come along. They need to be very respectable gigs, very formal stuff. And usually this kind don't pay as much as a lot of all those popular music gigs. So that was the next crisis that he had to face. And it was tough on him because his two children were growing up at that time in their teenage years, approaching teenage years. And he really needs to take good care of them, you know, giving them. And he was teaching his younger son the saxophone. He has shown a lot of promise and talent. He needs to really nurture him. So he has to make that decision. And he decided, okay, we'll go through all these financial difficulties as a family. We'll do that. Let's start from scratch. So that's that musical crisis turned out for the better.
Yeah, in the book, you highlight these three concerts that he did, one in 1988, one in 1989, and one in 1994. Why were these concerts so important?
Sure. The 1988 concert was the first time that anyone under Socialist Vietnam held a solo recital with the saxophone. In other words, it's a huge message that, look, this is a really serious and proper mainstream instrument. We should give it the due respect. It could play just as serious music as any classical instrument. So he was performing transcribed classical music with guest musicians from the conservatoire as part of that recital. That the saxophone is not just a mainstream proper instrument, but it is also very much aligned with the musical values of Vietnam's traditional musical heritage. So the saxophone could perform original Vietnamese compositions that were based on or inspired by traditional music. So he commissioned three very famous composers. One of them was Tô Hùng Quân, another one was Hoàng Vân, to write this kind of instrumental music for him. So Hoàng Vân wrote a Dance of the Thai People for him, which is based on ethnic Thai folk music. And Tô Hùng Quân wrote a pretty avant-garde instrumental piece. There was some more like new age music of his time for him to play, to show that it's very compatible with Vietnamese values. It's not as Western as you think. And the third part of that 1988 concert was he introduced, as I mentioned earlier, this was at the height of the light music movement, 1980s. He introduced jazz as international light music, in the sense that we have all this Vietnamese light music, we have rock and pop that not many people agree with, but they consider as youth music, but we can have international proper light music, respectable instrumental music. So he introduced jazz pieces, jazz standards like In the Moon, Glenn Miller's In the Moon, Charlie Parker's Blue Needle. So he introduced this music to an audience comprising musical dignitaries in Vietnam, the leadership of the Conservatoire, the Association of Musicians, of the Ministry of Culture, of the different song and dance troupe, to show them that, see, this is all proper, high standard, high artistic value music played on the saxophone, and that includes jazz. But he called, at that time, let's just call it international light music, he's telling them. It was very well received, to such an extent that the following year, they said, you can do another one if you want. And he did the second one year later. And with different repertoire to show that, well, it's the repertoire of saxophone and jazz is quite diverse. So these two concerts, 1988 and 1989, they're very significant because, number one, introduced jazz as international light music. We don't have to call it jazz, we call it international light music. It's played in the public sphere. It was even broadcast on television because the television station came in, recorded a concert, and they broadcast on national TV. And it did influence subsequent generations of musicians. And it showed that the saxophone and jazz can be compatible with two things: Vietnamese traditional musical heritage and the high art music form that is classical music. It's nothing inferior to that. So they were very important. The 1994 concert is very, very significant because, as I mentioned in the book, it marked the birth of Vietnamese jazz, an original nuanced sound that you listen to it, you know it is jazz. But the forms, the tools used, quite different from the usual jazz we are familiar with from North America, from Europe, for Vietnamese listening to it, they will immediately find something familiar. Oh, that sounds quite a fair bit like this kind of traditional folk music I would have heard from this region, that region, or even from Hanoi. But it's very different. The melody is original. The rhythm is very different. The feel of it is very different, but it's just familiar. So it stands out in that sense that, oh, something new was born in the concert. That's the most significant aspect of the 1994 concert, because he introduced, he premiered three songs there. And that cannot be the end of the story. So he kind of laid out the trajectory for what's to come in the next decade, or in the next few years, in fact, for this to happen. And a little bit on a side note, in the sense that it's also significant because that was the first time that a Vietnamese musician, a jazz musician, played a full concert at Hanoi Opera House. Hanoi Opera House is considered as the pinnacle stage for any musician, serious musician in Vietnam. You cannot be a second-rate, third-rate musician to play on that stage in a solo concert. So that was really significant in that sense, that just like when Benny Goodman did the first jazz concert at Carnegie Hall, the significance was tremendous. People in classical music were like, wow, this is fantastic. This is great music. This is really high quality music. Jazz musicians were really proud. And they say, we are not just dance hall and jazz club musicians. We can play in a proper music hall. And so the significance is the equivalent of what happened then. But here's the difference. Jazz was just beginning to emerge in Vietnam with this concert. It was nothing yet. But when Benny Goodman held a concert, jazz was huge in America. So it's tremendously significant in that sense.
I'm afraid we are running out of time here. There are so many more questions I have, and there's so much more in this book. Everyone has something to learn from this. It's such a wonderful book. My final question before I let you go, as is tradition on the New Books Network, is can you tell us what you're working on now?
So, there's two parts to this in my answer to your question. The first part is just yesterday I sent off the page proofs for a follow-up book on jazz in socialist Vietnam. So the title of this book is Jazz in Socialist Hanoi, Improvisations Between Worlds. This is not a collaborative narrative writing exercise. This is a very scholarly approach that analyzes the history of jazz in socialist Vietnam from 1954 until the present day. The authorship, this book I wrote everything, but it has close collaboration with almost all the musicians in Hanoi, jazz musicians in Hanoi. Every one of them contributed in bits and pieces. But two of them really facilitated the work. They spent many mornings, afternoons, and nights with me talking about their own experiences, talking about their own take, about the development of jazz. So one of them was Liu Guangming, Professor Liu Guangming, who, if Ming was the one who founded the jazz club and started all this thing, Professor Liu Guangming was the one who pushed for the jazz program to be developed at the National Conservatoire and finally becoming a faculty of jazz. So the two of them were very key in developing jazz in Vietnam. So Professor Liu Guangming spent many mornings and afternoons with me, telling me about his experience, his own take, his analysis. And the other one is Quyen Van Ninh's son, Quyen Thien Dac, who, following in his father's footsteps, continued to develop jazz, but in a very different way, in very different experimental way. So he took a lot more risk than the father, musically speaking, but at a time when a lot of things were a lot more acceptable already, and Dac himself fully understood the kind of risk his father took, the kind of sacrifice the father made in order to develop jazz. So they share a lot of things with me to such an extent that when I wrote the book, I felt that it was only right that I included the two of them as my collaborating author. So it's Stan Birchtan in collaboration with Liu Guangming and Quentin Tan for that book. It's going to be out in March. So it's a very different form of writing, but I think these two books goes very well together. But this book, for the general readers, they might find it a little bit boring because it's quite academic in that sense. But it's quite up to date. It covers until the developments that we see in the past year in Vietnam. What's happening to jazz then? The jazz club has been closed for 7 months because of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's been closed for 7 months. Anyone would have to close shop forever if you own a jazz club, right? So they're still waiting to reopen. So what happened during this time? So the last chapter actually dealt with this very up to date. So reading this book, Playing Jazz in Socialist Vietnam, academics, serious jazz musicians will have questions, so they can follow up with this. Any reader who read that book who are truly concerned about the people who plays jazz in Vietnam will want to know more of these personal stories, the narratives. What did they really go through? You want to read Playing Jazz in Socialist Vietnam. So that's part one of my answer to this. The other part is something that it's like kind of like going back to my earlier work. I'm halfway through a book on, there's a historical geography of the railway corridor from Kunming Yunnan all the way down to Haiphong in Vietnam. So this project took place many years ago. I wrote up almost 90% of manuscript then, but I wasn't happy with what I've written up. So I set everything aside. In the past few years, I started rewriting. So I've published two chapters elsewhere. I thought, okay, that direction worked. So I'm halfway through finishing that book. It will take me at least 6 more months to finish.
The book is Playing Jazz in Socialist Vietnam, published in 2021 with the University Press of Mississippi. Stan B.H. Tan Thang Bao, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Adam.